Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. And we are live here in the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner, and today, super excited to have Leah Conan on the show with me today. She has an amazing new book. It's called Keep Your Friends Close. And let me tell you, if you've ever met someone and had sneaking suspicions about them, this book will not help. it's such a fun read, Leah. Fun in a kind of a twisted way that I love and I think is fun. But it really will make you a little paranoid, and that's great for
that's the goal,
That's the goal.
A little paranoid.
And in your reading, you want all those emotions. Super fun. You're gonna love the book. It's not a thin book by any means, but it is a quick read. And by that, I mean, I didn't want to put it down. At the end of the chapter, okay, I'll just read one more chapter. And then, by the end of that, and then it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you've, lost yourself. So anyway, the book comes out on February the 20th. Go ahead and pre-order it now. We'll put links in the show notes where you can pre-order the book. This is one that you won't want to miss. I said all that to say, welcome to the show, Leah.
Thank you, Hank. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. We had a little scheduling snafu yesterday. So if you tuned in yesterday and we rescheduled to today, so apologies about that. But we are here now and excited to talk about the book. Leah, I'd love to start the show with a fun question to kind of set the stage. And one question that I love to ask people is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
So actually, I have a very clear answer for you. I had an amazing third grade teacher named Mrs. Sund, and she was so incredible. And she made, for all of us, she put us through this like publishing thing in third grade where it was literally corners of the classroom. And the first one was called topic ideas. And then it was like the second corner was like you would write it. And the third corner, I think, was that you would illustrate it. And the fourth corner of the room was you'd bind it and then you could read it to the class. And honestly, if I talk about it, I just like how brilliant it was that she created this.
She's
and
a literal superhero.
Totally. And then this was the other thing that you might not expect is it wasn't like, okay, we'll do this, thing all together as a class, like this is our thing for the spring or whatever. It was you could move through it at your own pace and you could do as many books as you wanted. So like you could do a really short like picture focused book or you could do a longer story. It was very much adapted to the abilities and the desires of each child. So I did several actually. And the first one I did was like, it was a book about like tickles and like liking to be tickled or whatever. And that was short. But then once I kind of got that out of my system, of course, like a prolific author that I was, even apparently at the time, I wanted to do more. And then the second one I did was longer. And it was called The Rose Garden, about this girl who goes and discovers this kingdom of rose queen and king fairies who live like within a rose in her backyard, and she gets shrunk down and gets to go see this kingdom. And I think just the way that was, that whole year was set up really unlocked something that was definitely there. I'd always loved reading and writing and telling stories, but that made it different. It made it feel like something you could actually do and like hold in your hands. And then kind of that was it.
I've had so many people tell me I can relate to this experience. I don't necessarily have a particular memory of it. But when you're young, books just kind of are ethereal. They just exist. And you know, we don't really know where they come from, but we walk down the aisle of a library or a bookstore and they're just everywhere. But one day, for whatever reason, you start connecting books to people and you realize that someone wrote this book. And then at some other point in life, you start to realize that it's more than just one person. There's probably an editorial staff who have, you know, some input working back and forth with the author to really shape that text into what it will become ultimately. And then there are bookbinders and, you know, all the people that are involved in that process. And then there are all the people that are involved in the book selling process. And you start realizing that this thing that you just took for granted as just always being there comes from the mind of a person. And then a whole host of people help bring that into the world. And it sounds like your third grade teacher was really clued into kind of pulling back the curtain for kids like that. That is amazing.
It was honestly. And I credit her with a lot of that desire that kind of has stuck with me.
Yeah. So from that point to where you are now, what got you into writing, you know, for publication? Because, you know, a lot of times we'll write stories for ourselves or to share with family members or whatever. But then there's usually a point where, okay, I'm going to take this hobby that I'm, you know, excited about, proud of, and try to take this to a professional level. What was that kind of demarcation for you?
So for me, it was, I'd always kind of, you know, I kept on writing. Maybe I didn't write fiction as much. I wrote stories when I was a kid, and then I kind of moved on. I got really into like visual art as when I was, you know, an adolescent and kind of in high school. And I'd always been told, you know, teachers would tell me if I did an essay, oh, you know, you really have a good way with words. And so I went off to college and, you know, being someone who knew that I was there on student loans. I knew I was going to have to support myself right out of school. Mm-hmm. I loved English, but I decided to major in journalism instead because it felt more practical. And this is back in like 2006. So like it was more practical. That's probably not as practical now, but
yeah. You would at be the surprised time, how many practical. People have told me that.
Really? Okay. Yeah, like I would have loved to majored in English Lit, but I just didn't. I was just scared. You know, I graduated with, you know, like 40K of student debt. And I felt that I had to have something, you know, that was like a very translatable skill, like right out of the bat. So then, you know, I got to like my senior year of college and I'm kind of realizing I'd done some internships and done some work on newspapers, and I'm realizing that this is just not for me. Like, I do not want to be a newspaper journalist. I have no desire to do it. Like, I, you know, like the intensity of like following a beat and a story just like gave me anxiety. I didn't like it. So I decided to pivot to magazine journalism because it kind of had all of this storytelling that attracted me, but it was a little bit of a slower pace, maybe a longer form. Things like that. And at the time, you really had to be, this is again before most magazines folded, you had to be in New York City. So I decided to move to New York. And then very quickly, once I was there, I was there. I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't have a community. I was going to a lot of events, book events at, it's now McNally Jackson, but it used to be called something else in Soho, because it was just a free thing to do. And I would find that kind of to the point you made a couple minutes ago, it was like this light bulb moment of like, oh, these are the people who are writing books, but they're not like famous movie star authors, like untouchable. Like they're just regular people who are doing this. And, you know, again, this is all before like social media was like this explosion for authors. And there was, you know, things like this all the time. So you wouldn't see authors kind of speaking about their craft, except for in events like these. And so moving to New York, it really just changed my perception of what it meant. And so it didn't feel like this faraway dream. Oh, I should write a book one day. It felt like, okay, this is something I could do if I actually kind of put my mind to this.
Right.
And so I did. And definitely like a lot of ups and downs to get there, but I did finish my first book. I didn't publish that, but the next one was published after that. And I think it was just, it was really the first time I believed that it was a legitimate and possible career path, even for someone who is not famous and not independently wealthy and all of that, because I was meeting working writers in New York, like left and right.
So what was the idea for the first book that you
wrote?
Let me tack on a question to that. Was the first book that you wrote to completion, was that your first book that was published?
No. So the first book I wrote was called From Scratch, and it was about this girl. It was YA. So I wrote YA for the first bit of my career. I was a YA novelist. So it was about this girl who is living in New York City, and she has to, her parents get divorced, and she has to move to this small farming town in Washington State where I grew up, and basically work on a cherry orchard for the summer. And,
right,
what you know. Yeah. So, well, I didn't actually know anything about cherry orchards, but because we lived in the farming town, but we were not a farming family. So I had to talk to some friends. But so it was this very sweet kind of, you know, fish out of water, young romance story about adapting to this new world and, you know, letting some of your previous biases go. And it was really sweet. And I don't have any regret that it wasn't published. Because I don't think it really needed to be. I think it needed to be written for me, and I've shared it with, you know, family, especially my family who grew up there, and it's, you know, very special to them. But I think that's kind of where that.
Did you query that novel?
I did, and I got my agent with it. But it just didn't sell for whatever reason. Which I think is extremely common, and a lot of people don't know or don't talk about is that, you know, a lot of people have not just one book, but many books that are written to completion before they get agents, before they sell traditionally, before, you know, they do any, if they pursue self-publishing before they do that. So really common. That's kind of.
Writing is an interesting thing in that, someone can invest a half a year, multiple years on a book that they poured everything that they have into, and then send it out into the world and it not get published. And a writer will just say, okay, I'll just try again. Whereas, you know, there are so many other professions that people would just be like, well, I guess I'm not a writer, you know, and then, you know, go on to be a chef or whatever, you know.
Sure.
There's something, I don't know if it's brilliant or a little demented about the writer's mind that says, well, I'll just start over and I'll just, you know, invest another year of my life into this thing.
I think it's both. I think it is both.
You're right.
But I think there's a difference between some people get into something because they have this one story that they want to tell. And for whatever reason, that's what they're there to do. They're like, I need to get this specific story out. And that if it doesn't work, it can obviously be heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking either way, like, you know, but I think for me, it was less about one story over another. It was more about the act of storytelling and writing. And I say this now, like looking back, I'm sure I didn't really probably feel this way then, but I think I've been able to kind of surf the rises and falls and the ebbs and flows of the business because I just like writing. Like I get anxious if I don't have a project I'm working on. So if something doesn't go right with one book, I keep going and I do the next one because it's what I like to do. It's what I feel kind of compelled to do.
Yeah.
And I really think I do, for whether you're a budding novelist or you're a seasoned novelist, I think the best way to kind of process what happens with any story is to be already moved on. Because right. At the end, because you really have no control. Like you have almost zero control.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, if I get the book deal, then I'll have control. Or if I hit the New York Times bestseller list, then I'll have control. But it's not true. You know, at every level, people are still, I get together with writers of all varying levels of success and fame and financial success. And we're all kind of going through the same issues. Like, you put the story out there, and then at the end of the day, you can do very much more than that to control how the world is going to receive it.
Right. You mentioned a few minutes ago, and I had this written down to ask you, in digging through your back catalog, you started writing YA, and then there was a point where you switched to what I would consider kind of your genre of choice now, which is kind of psychological thriller, you know, mystery, that sort of. What drew you to YA, and why do you think you were, that's where you wanted to plant your flag in the beginning?
So I think YA was a bit accidental. I had taken a YA writing class in college, and then I got to New York, and there was another class that ended up being amazing. I made a million friends in it, and the teacher is still, well, now she's a friend, but she was a mentor to me for many years. And so I had taken a couple of classes, and it just kind of felt like, okay, like, I'll try writing, you know, a YA book. At the time, also, I wasn't really necessarily expecting any of it to work. Like, I didn't know, you know, I was like 22. I didn't know I was going to get an agent out of this or any of that. But I think at the time, it made sense for me to write. I needed a bit of space. And so at 22, writing about, you know, a 16-year-old felt right to me. You know, it felt doable.
More honest.
Yeah, it just felt like something that I could, not even more honest, but something I could just wrap my head around.
Yeah.
More, you know, something I could actually do.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of the space I was in. So then I continued to do it. And then, but I was always feeling like I wanted to go explore different things. And I was just like this huge, like, mystery horror movie, like Alfred Hitchcock, like, aficionado. And so I was finding that in my time as a reader, I was not really reading YA. I was reading mysteries and thrillers, and especially psychological thrillers. I would say this was like, you know, before like Gone Girl, like, this was like when, yeah, you know, I was reading like Gillian Flynn's like earlier books, and like, I just was obsessed with this genre. And so then it became to the point where it's like, okay, well, why am I not writing it? I think there was a fear there. Like, okay, I know how to write YA. I have this track record there. I've proven to publishers I can do it. Can I just go write a bit? Like, not only can I just write for adults versus YA, but can I write a mystery and have it actually work? Like, this is a completely different thing. And I just decided it was worth the risk because that's what I wanted to do. And I left my agent as well because she was a YA agent. Again, I had signed with her when I was very young. I was like 22 or 23. And I felt that I needed to take everything in a very different direction. And so it was a risk, but it, you know, it was motivated by kind of passion, which I think is the best reason to take a risk. Like, it wasn't like financial duress or like something where I was like, okay, I have to switch because of X reason. It was like, I really want to switch because this is what I feel passionate about.
Yeah. Well, as an established author in the YA space with an agent and a relationship with a publishing house, I'm sure, and, you know, everything's kind of solid, you know, for whatever reason. When you decided to switch to YA and you needed to get a new agent and all that, did you start from scratch? Did you write a novel hoping that you could sell it? Or were you able to get a new agent based on your past experience?
So I did a little mix of both. So I decided to leave my prior agent, and I wanted to let her know before I started querying, which is obviously the right thing you're supposed to do, but some people do not do that. But I wanted, out of respect to her and our relationship,
sure,
to really do it the right way.
Yeah.
But then I I had this really strong idea that I felt, which turned into my first thriller, All the Broken People. And but I thought, like, look, I've written 5 books. They know I can write a book. So let me just write a partial and see. And I queried, I think, 10 or 12 agents. And some of them even said, we don't accept partials, you know, whatever. But I was like, I'm going to throw it out and see what comes back. And then if nothing comes back, then I'll just write the whole book. But I was still having stuff was happening in my YA career as well. So I really wanted representation. I was in this kind of weird spot. So I wrote like 70 pages, wrote a really strong query letter, and I sent it out on, it was like before a holiday weekend. It was like end of October. And I ended up getting like 6 offers in like 10 days or something. It was wild. Like I did not expect it at all. I only got 1 no out of the whole thing. I think I hit it right at the right time for the genre. I think my pages were obviously resonating with people. And then I think that there was a little flexibility that maybe if I had never written a book before, maybe they would have felt like, no, I really need to see the whole thing. Sure. So there was a little flexibility where I think people were okay with the partial element. That said, it definitely came back to bite me though, because that book was the hardest to write. And I ended up revising it with my agent like for like over a year. And like, I was so worried that my agent was going to drop me because it just, we couldn't get it to work. So definitely, like, I feel like those are always the success stories of like, I sold it on a partial, or I did this and I didn't have to write the whole thing. But it can be harder too, because then, you know, it's just different than having a whole book to be like, here, this is what we're selling.
Yeah. So it that obviously worked. All the Broken People was a success. The Perfect Escape, You Should Have Told Me, and now Keep Your Friends Close. One thing that I'm fascinated by is the moment of creation. In one moment, something like, you know, Keep Your Friends Close doesn't exist at all. But then either a character walks onto the stage of your mind and you're like, well, who is she? And what, you know, what is she up to? Or maybe you read something, a news article, or overhear a conversation or whatever. And then the what if, you know, starts playing in your mind. And then as the writer, you know, your job is to kind of dig that thing out of the ground and then, you know, excavate it and polish it up. And then it is a book, you know, and you know, then you go and tell the story and edit it and all that. But what is that first moment of creation usually like for you?
It depends on the book. It's so different for every book. But usually I would say it's the seed of what I would call a Twilight Zone episode idea. And I have one pretty much. So for All the Broken People, it was like, what if someone agrees to help someone fake someone's death, but then the person actually turns up dead anyway? And then The Perfect Escape was, what if you were going on this girl's trip and then your car breaks down in a town you're not supposed to be in, but it like weird stuff starts happening and feels like, were you supposed to be there, kind of thing? Anyway, for Keep Your Friends Close, I had this, so I was a new mom. I had like an 18-month-old, and I had just, we had been out of New York City for most of the pandemic. And then we were just coming back, and I was going to the playground all the time. And you just meet all these other parents at the playground. And it's just very easy to like, you know, like, oh, hey, like, what's your kid's name? And like, oh, what are you guys, how old? And what are they doing? And I'm like, so what if you met someone at a playground, another mom, and then you kind of got a little close to them, and then they kind of disappear out of your life for whatever reason, and then you see them again a few months later in another place with a different name and a completely different family? Like, what in the world? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It was that, like, what? What do you think? Like, if you just saw someone who you knew as a mom of this child, and then you saw them with a completely different family, And so that was kind of the inflection point. But then there was also, I had mentioned I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. So it was also kind of the parallel creative idea was that Strangers on a Train, if the train was a Brooklyn playground, and instead of these two guys, it's two mothers.
Love it. Twilight Zone was such an iconic thing that I think affected so many storytellers. And you know, Rod Serling was a master of that twist. There was usually always a twist in the last couple of minutes of the show, and you're like, oh wow, I never saw that coming. And it really worked well for a 30-minute television episode. And then when you take out commercial breaks, it's like 21 to 3.
Sure, yeah. Minutes,
which is like kind of short story length, you know, the perfect. But when you're telling a novel and you've got like 400 pages to draw this story out, and you know that the twist is what's going to make people go nuts over it. But, you know, you've got a lot of space there to play with. And like in Keep Your Friends Close, there are multiple twists and there are turns. And then you're in the beginning, you're like, oh, I know what this story is about. And you're like, oh, no, I don't. And it's okay. Now I get it. It's this kind of story. No, it's not. You know, so how do you start thinking about the journey that you're going to take the reader on? Because I would assume there's a lot of planning in a book like this where, okay, I'm going to steer over here, but that's not really it. So I'm going to steer over here, and then I'm ultimately going to work to this big kind of reveal at the end. What's your planning process like? Or are you a complete pantser?
So I'm not a pantser. I'm a total planner. And yet still this book threw me for a loop because when I look back at it, I'm like, I have no idea how I plotted that out. Like I don't know, because it was the first book I'd done dual points of view narrators before. No. I'd done it in YA. I did it actually with The Perfect Escape too. And I'd done it a couple times in YA. And I'd done maybe dual timeline, maybe. I can't remember. But this one was dual narrators and dual timeline. Mm-hmm. And it was like this then now thing happening. And then a character is added, a narrator is added. And then, you know, you're basically watching, as you're watching Mary's story unfold in the present, you're going back and seeing Willa's story through Willa's narration of things that you saw happen from Mary's right. perspective. So that was a lot of puzzle pieces that, like, and the cogs and wheels that I hadn't really played with before. Mm-hmm. And so I did plot it the same way I always do, which is I use save the cat screenwriting method, the beat sheet. And then I also use Anatomy of Story by John Truby, which is, there you go. Yeah, you got it. It's literally propped up my computer right now. Yeah. Because this is how often I use it. But so I did do that. But then, so for the overarching beats and everything, that was the same process as always. But it was kind of like a plotting, pantsing thing together, because I would each, for like a chapter by chapter or scene by scene thing, I would only do it one act at a time. Like I'd be like, I'm going to get through the first 80 pages of this book. And after that, I could not just sit down and write out every chapter, because there was too much back and forth and baton passing. And like you're playing with this balance of wanting to tell a story from both sides without it feeling repetitive. Like we're just going right. back to the same moment and showing it again.
Were you so, like, okay, what new information can I give the reader by switching to this perspective?
Yeah. Well, and honestly, that my editors helped a lot with that, because there were times when I would have the scene and they'd be like, we felt like we already read this from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So we need to trim out everything that we've seen and make sure to pick up in a very strong way that doesn't just recap. So yeah, it was definitely a learning process, but I love the way it turned out. And I think I had a lot of fun with it. And I'm continuing for my next book that I just finished drafting. I also played with a dual POV and dual timeline, because I think it can be a lot of fun. So yeah, it was really exciting. It was just kind of teaching myself to do a new thing. yet again. But I mean, writing is always just teaching yourself to do a thing or reminding yourself to do a thing that you totally forgot that you could do.
Do you have a solid ending in mind before you start drafting, or do you kind of write by feel and kind of let it be a surprise to you at the end? How do you handle endings?
For Keep Your Friends Close, the ending changed like 100 times.
Of course it did.
It really did, because I was just like, I was playing with a source material of Strangers on a Train, and I'm like, do I want to go? And then there's two Strangers on a Train. You have the Highsmith novel, which is a completely different ending than the film. So I was playing with both of those.
Right.
And then I was playing with like what makes sense for these women. And so I actually wrote through a few different endings, a few different killers for sure. This was one where I think because you were so close to the two women, and I was playing so much with what they knew versus what they were sharing with the reader versus what they were sharing with each other, I did have to make a lot of changes, because, you know, the first thing that might occur to me is also the first thing that's going to occur to these very astute and very clever readers, who the readers are like, the readers in this genre are like the smartest readers of any. I mean, they're eagle-eyed, and they see things and anticipate things, and they know all your tricks. So I think it's a constant battle of trying to create something that's believable, that feels earned, but also that will surprise some people. So there was a lot of changing.
Well, and you're right. That's getting more and more difficult, because, you know, there was a sea change when Gone Girl came out, you know, that the unreliable narrator. Now everyone's doing an unreliable narrator. And now you start a book and your first instinct is almost, well, should I believe her? I don't know that I believe her, you know. And then, so then you have the trouble of building rapport with a character, and, you know, why do I care about this character? And I know she's just going to pull the rug out from under me. And that is a difficult thing to, you know, how do you make a likable character when the reader knows this may not last?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I have no clue. Yeah, my characters are all over the map on whether they're likable or not.
You're right.
I don't know. But no, I think versus something being likable, my question would be, how do you write a character that people can connect with, because they can empathize with their wants and needs? Right. And desires, even if they don't agree with their decision. Like,
true.
You know, like, do we understand where they're coming from enough to root for them, even if they're doing things that we would never do? And I think Willa in Keep Your Friends Close is definitely the morally grayest character, because she is doing a lot of things that are very shady. But sometimes her motivations can be, I don't want to give too much away, but her motivations at different parts of the book can be honorable.
Yeah.
Depending on how you read it. So, and what's funny is people actually have really connected with her and have called her very likable. And it's hilarious, because I've written women who are like much more like by the book who get called unlikable. So it's like, it's almost like the likability question needs to just go away. And if what we're really asking is, can we stand in this character's shoes, and do we feel compelled to do it?
Yeah.
Because we all have a character like, say, Cersei Lannister, who's like the biggest monster in the world, right? And yet we love to watch her, because we could just like get in her brain, even though it's the most messed up place, you know, and it's pure evil. So I think that's kind of something that you have to think about, is like creating characters that are very, very kind of honest and earnest about what they want, and that helps us really connect with them.
Yeah. If we know anything about publishing, now that Keep Your Friends Close is coming out in stores, I guess in a week and a half from now, this has probably been off of your desk for quite a while. you know, as it goes through the publishing process. But what are you working on now, Leah?
So I am super excited. It's a book, a mystery set in an old revitalized roadside motel. And I've kind of been inspired by The Shining, and it's kind of like a feminist like take on a writer who basically goes up to this motel to be a caretaker for the winter season. And then things, of course, go very awry. So I've actually just finished that and I'm drafting it or about to do revisions on it. So it's been super fun. I think one thing I've always found, and I found this in my YA career as well, is like anytime I feel like I'm getting in this place where, you know, I've written a bunch of books and I'm feeling stuck, I love to dramatically change the environment. And season is actually like to me the best one. So it's just like set it in winter, make there snow on the ground, like it's trapped, like there's no electricity, like let these characters kind of bounce around within a very tight time frame. So I'm really excited about that.
Oh, I can't wait. That's going to be amazing. Leah Conan, this has been so much fun chatting. Keep Your Friends Close will be available everywhere February 20th. We'll put links to it in the show notes where you can order it from Amazon or Audible or Kindle Edition, or go visit your local bookstore, support local books, and make sure you get your pre-order in, or go visit the store on February 20th and pick up Keep Your Friends Close. Leah, have you listened to the audiobook yet?
I haven't. No, I feel like
I just finished it yesterday in audio. Amazing.
How do I get to hear it? How are you? Nobody's even sent it to me.
they sent me an audio arc.
I have the best narrators. And so Kristen Navarro, I've worked with on several books now, and every time I'm like, I just want her. Like, she's so good. And then we had for the other narrator, I actually checked in with my friend who's not a publishing professional, but she just adores audiobooks, and she sent me some names. So, I really love to talk to, like, versus talking just to people like Penguin Random House, like, you know, who are producing the books or other writers. Like, I love to talk to people who are obsessed with audiobooks because they're like connoisseurs, and it's a totally different thing. Like, what, you know, they're very, very particular, as they should be, because it is a totally different experience. So I've just been so happy with the narrators.
Well, I read the physical copy that I got sent by Penguin Random House weeks ago, and I love it. And then when the audio arc came out, I gave it a listen, because you're right, it's a totally different experience. I know where the story's going, but once you kind of start falling into the voices and these characters, just inhabit the story. And even though you know where it's going, it's a new experience and so much fun. So I highly recommend the audio when it comes out. Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Leah, if people are just discovering you and want to dig through your back catalog and find more great reads, and follow along for news coming up, is there a place online where they can follow you?
Yes. LeahConan.com, just first name, last name.com, has all of my books. You can subscribe to my Substack. And then I'm also, of course, on Twitter and Instagram, also Leah Conan handles. So I keep it really simple. And then you can see pictures of my dog on the website as well. He's very cute.
Love it. We'll try to link up all of those in the show notes to make it easier for folks to find you. Leah, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you for taking time to come on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.